if you just scratch a little below the surface, there's stories of how people are kind of finding new ways to express their Judaism, or because of their Jewish values, are just making a difference in the general community.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to the NextGen podcast, a conversational series with members from Energen Wealth Partners at UBS. With an understanding of the family dynamics that can accompany multi-generational wealth, we are experienced in working with you and your family to develop a strategic plan to guide your decisions. Our approach helps provide education across generations to help define and support your long-term vision for your wealth.
Welcome to the NextGen podcast. I'm your host, Sean Nicholson, financial advisor with Energen Wealth Partners here at UBS Financial Services. Our office is located in Dayton, Ohio, and you can reach us at energen@ubs.com. I'm thrilled to have a very special guest with us today. Joining me is Marshall Weiss, the editor and publisher of the Dayton Jewish Observer. Marshall is an accomplished author who has written extensively about Jewish history in Dayton. His works, including the insightful book Stories of Jewish Dayton from American Heritage, have uncovered the rich and often overlooked history of Jewish life in the Miami Valley. Today, we'll be diving into Marshall's fascinating books and articles, exploring the stories and history that he has brought to life through his writing. We'll also discuss his contributions to the community through his role as the editor of the Dayton Jewish Observer. Whether you're a history enthusiast or simply curious about the Jewish community in Dayton, this conversation promises to be both informative and engaging. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the vibrant stories and history that Marshall Weiss has so wonderfully captured. Well, welcome, Marshall. We're certainly glad to have you with us today. It's been a great joy of mine to be able to discover your books and learn a little bit about you. I hadn't really had a chance to read them. I've read several books about the history of Dayton over the years, but these bring a special, particular part of Dayton history that I had not known about. So I sure appreciate what you've done there and your longtime history. In fact, your work now at the Jewish Observer has almost made you part of Dayton history that somebody will be writing about at some point in the future too, I think.
Well, thank you, Sean.
So can you tell us a bit about your background and what inspired you to start writing about Jewish history in Dayton?
Sure. Well, I've always been a history guy. I grew up in Philadelphia. And as you know, if anywhere you step in Center City, Philadelphia, you're going to come across history, amazing yes. history and plaques. I've been doing, as you said, this paper for quite a while now, almost 30 years. I've got a master's degree in journalism from Temple University. And when I started this paper, in very short order, I needed to know the history of the Jewish community. Obviously, you can't write about what's going on now unless you figure out how we got here.
Good point.
And the other thing is when people recognized, oh, here's somebody new to town and he's going to be writing about Dayton's Jewish community, members of the Jewish community would share their recollections, their stories of old Jewish Dayton. Some of these were kind of tall tales. Some of these are urban legends. Some of them sounded incredible. And I just kind of started making a kind of a mental list of these are stories that I must find out what happened.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've been able to do that and find out, okay, this is exactly what happened. Well, no, this isn't exactly what happened. And this one, no, that just didn't happen at all. Those kind of things. And as I went along, I found stories in the Jewish community that people weren't familiar with, even the old timers.
Yeah.
They weren't aware of them. Or perhaps if I bring them up to them, maybe they jog their memory, they forgot about them. Some stories, maybe they just didn't want to remember. So I always feel that there's a responsibility that people should know their history, that it's
right.
our birthright. And
right.
And what a tragedy not to know what happened.
Right.
So that you can see what's going on today. How does this compare? How
right.
does it, what are the similarities? What are the differences? So,
well, I learned the story of the Jewish immigration through Dayton, and that basically told the whole story of Dayton immigration from one perspective. Mm-hmm. And it was such a great story that you told because everybody can relate to how Dayton got formed and built. And what was so fun was reading a lot of the names that I'd been familiar with but never knew the background story, and learned a lot about different parts of Dayton and the history. And so it mirrors a lot of Dayton history from a specific point of view. So what you've done here is an incredible storytelling for this particular immigration that came in and then formed into some great businesses and business leaders and important people and great contributors to the whole Dayton and Miami Valley area here. But before we get too much, I want to, what was your journey like in starting the newspaper business? Because you were really the person who started the whole newspaper there too, right? The Jewish Observer was started when you came to town, right?
Yeah, it was an absolute dream come true. I was out in the San Francisco area in Marin working for a Jewish community center. And I had heard through kind of the Jewish professional world that the Jewish community here in Dayton was starting a Jewish newspaper. And how often do you get to start something from nothing, from the ground up?
Yeah.
So I applied and I got it. And I remember my first day at work was January 2nd, 1996. And they said, okay, we want our first newspaper by April for Passover. Boom. And I put it all together, and there were many, many sleepless nights, and then realized, oh, I have to do another one next month, and the next month, and the next month. And it's been a dream come true. There had been privately published mom and pop newspaper here probably for 30 years, and it had gone through a succession of ownerships. And with the Jewish population had declined over the generations here. And with that, it just became more difficult to sustain it as a for-profit. So the model here is we're nonprofit.
Got it.
And we are officially owned and operated by the Jewish Federation of Greater Dayton. Think about what the United Way does for the general community.
Sure.
Right. Jewish Federation is for the Jewish community.
Your book, The Jewish Community, I noticed a picture of a paper boy that you had in there going back, I guess it was in the 20s or 30s, that picture, and that there was a Jewish newspaper being sold right on the street of downtown Dayton alongside of the Dayton Dailies.
It's one of my favorite photos, and I use it when I give presentations, where I'll show the newsstand, 1921, and then I'll zero in on the Yiddish newspapers, not local papers, obviously, but Yiddish press.
Yeah.
There's two things that I really try to get across when it comes to history. And the first is, we were here.
Yeah.
We were here. And we've been here since the 1840s, since the 1840s. And that's really, even so many people, American Jews, don't live in the smaller communities. They're really concentrated in the New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. So there's even a stereotype across this country with American Jews. They don't necessarily think of Jews living in smaller communities. There's not so much awareness of it. And we have been here since the beginning. And there have been Jews living in communities much smaller than Dayton going back that far.
Right.
You try to find opportunity wherever it is. And then the other thing that I really try to get across is that, and when I'm writing about history, is that no community lives in a vacuum, and no community should live in a vacuum. And from the very beginnings, what interests me the most is how members of the Jewish community interacted with members of other communities and the general community, and how they worked with each other or how they confronted prejudice. So those have kind of been my two things.
Yes.
That we're here and we're not a vacuum.
Right, right. No, I love some of the early stories there about how, you know, some of the people had come up from Cincinnati and, you know, worked with some of the people in Dayton. In fact, some of your early stories there about, you know, some of the community getting together forming the early churches and synagogues, and, you know, the community getting together and how it inspired people to open businesses and the food industry and the catering industry and how all that came in and how kosher was kind of questionable even among the community there, what was considered kosher among certain groups and others, and how that can create even discussion among, you know, groups like yourself right there.
Yeah, yeah. And any group that comes into a new situation, you know, immigrating to the new world, whether it's a conscious thing or just a trial and error thing, you've got to navigate what is it that you keep and what is it that you leave behind. And for the Jews coming here, they came out of oppression. The first Jews to come here were from Germany, the German principalities, in a time of much political unrest, financial instability, and for the Jews, prejudice. So those early Jews that came here from Bavaria and Prussia in the 1840s, where they came from, they were restricted from getting married. Only a certain number of Jews were allowed to get married every year. Places they could live, businesses they could go to. When they came here, the Jews that ended up in Dayton tended originally to come from Cincinnati because that was the easiest way to get here.
Came down the river, I assume,
right.
And
it was
got
very,
up to Cincinnati.
Yeah,
and then,
very difficult to get here otherwise until the advent of the railroads.
So, yes.
Yeah, the first Jews that we know of were these Jews from Prussia and Bavaria that came up here from Cincinnati.
Yes.
And the pattern for the German Jewish immigrants, and also later on the Eastern European immigrants that would come in the 1880s, was you make something out of nothing.
Yeah.
So you maybe you have a few goods and you have a case and you peddle. You walk roads between cities and peddle, and then you do a little better and you can rent a cart. And then you do better and you can rent a horse. And then you do better and you can buy a cart and a horse. And then if you're lucky, you can get a market stand. And then ultimately you can establish your own merchant business.
Yes.
And that seems to have been the pattern for most of our, our immigrants.
So many businesses have been Jewish owned and developed. It's really an all-day story. We could sit and talk about all the different people that have been here and opened businesses and developed them from the clothing industry to the food industry to manufacturing, just on and on, advertising and accounting and law and everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, part of that is also the acceptance and respect of those beyond the Jewish community who really were fair and welcoming to the Jewish community in those early days. This community, there's always, of course, there's always prejudice, nothing like the old world. But on the whole, the community has been good to members of the Jewish community, and the Jewish community have really kind of sought out ways to improve the community, the social life, the civic life of the community.
Right.
So I would say that we've always had a seat at the table.
Well, and I found it interesting how you did address the early prejudice. And I didn't know some of the stories about certain communities and how they were exclusive. And then it worked hard to become inclusive, and how you were, you know, so instrumental in working with race relations back in the 60s when Dayton was really having troubles there. And the Jewish community was, you know, kind of an in-between, trying to bring it all together and really worked hard at encapsulating what was important to bring the community as a whole into the right way to live together, and how all that was central to what the Jewish community was doing.
Yeah, I really made a point in my second book to dig into those racial restrictions, those racial housing restrictions, because you hear this.
Yeah, people didn't know.
And I mean, in the Jewish community, we knew.
I mean, a lot of people like myself here coming, and that's not talked about. It's overlooked, unfortunately, but it needs to be remembered and talked about on a regular basis, because it's an important part of our history that we need to acknowledge and learn from.
And what I found was that nobody had really dug into it locally. So when I contacted the county, the records office, the archival materials, they told me, you know, you're the first person who's ever asked for this. And they were great, because it was in the back of their minds. They hadn't dug deep into research on this, but when they would happen to pull a deed and there was a restriction on it, they noted it. They remembered that.
Yes. Yes. I didn't realize, you know, some of those restrictions that were actually written into the code there. And, you know, I knew that, you know, they probably were some really problematic things among certain communities that they didn't want. And I think that still exists today, unfortunately, in parts of the Miami Valley that we don't recognize. But so we still need to address it even today and continue to learn from that. That's why it's
not
important
the most
you wrote
comfortable
this book.
Subject. But
no, but it's important that you write about that, because we all need to rethink and re-know what's going on. Mm-hmm. On another note, I noticed, you know, it was great to learn about the Schwartz sisters. And I knew about them because I've always been active in the arts community. And but I never realized some of that, where, you know, who they were from a perspective of the immigration process.
Yeah, and their family goes way back to the German Jewish community in Cincinnati. Their father, Joe Schwartz, also, I didn't get to this in that last book, but probably in the next book. He was basically the scoutmaster for the Jewish scout troop. He started it, and he was a scoutmaster for many, many years.
Okay.
And the Schwartz sisters, the most important thing to them was bringing people together through dance, and they were able to do so by opening the studio on Linden Avenue for Black students on the West Side to be able to learn to dance.
Right. So, that was the early DCDC, right?
Right.
And
they were
early
there.
Ballet.
Yeah, and they championed DCDC in its early days. And
yes. Yes. Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, that history unless they're really involved in the arts, but
right. Right.
You know,
so that's what we're here to remind people of. Those that should be remembered, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that was really interesting for me to learn a little deeper of what I hadn't known of their parents and things like that.
Yeah.
And I still think you probably have another full book of stories written just in that time frame of other people you're learning about, too.
Yeah. And for the first book I did, which is basically a visual history of Dayton, it was tough to make choices because for every photo that's in that book, there's probably 100 behind it that I could have.
Yes, yes, I'm sure that's true.
Space to run, so
yes,
so there could be another one in that series.
Uh huh. Yes.
And we also, with that first book, we made lists upon lists upon lists of okay, who should we include in this? We had exhaustive lists, and I would go to their family and kind of try to explain as best I could what we were looking for. You know, sometimes the family would be like, well, we've got a pile of things in the attic we haven't sorted it through, or they didn't fully understand exactly what I was trying to do. And then when the book came out, they're like, oh, I wish I had given you this photo. Well, next cycle. But the other thing that we've done to keep this alive, to keep it really kind of an interactive thing, once we published that visual history, we opened a social media site on Facebook.
Nice. Called
Growing Up Jewish in Miami Valley.
Ah.
And
great to know.
This is, I'm going to put up the old photos that I've got, and I want you to share.
Oh, that would be
your
fun
old photos
to contribute.
And,
sure.
Yeah, this has been going on since 2019. And now the Jewish community that we are aware of, there are about 2,700 people. Maybe there's a third more that would identify as Jewish that we don't know.
Sure.
And there are a lot of expatriates, people who live around the country,
right.
If not in
Israel.
Yeah,
oh yeah.
Within a month, we had 1,000 people at this website, at the social media site. Probably most of them expatriates. Most of them grew up in Dayton, and they didn't even remember. And it kind of touched them so much. And what I expected people to enjoy that. What I didn't expect were the reunions.
Uh-huh.
We have people who will reconnect at our social media site that haven't seen each other in 40, 50 years. I'm your cousin.
Yes.
Remember, we were friends as kids? And that kind of thing happens, you know, almost every week when I put some.
How fun is that? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must be exciting for you to hear those different stories and learn about that you brought that much together.
And the other way it helps me, there are so many archival photos that we have that were never captioned. So many, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
Yes.
Because when they were taken, we knew who they
were. You knew who that was.
Right.
Yeah.
When we were setting up the archive for the Jewish Federation out at Wright State, we brought together as many of the oldest people we could to try to caption photos.
Oh,
but
nice.
there's still a lot missing.
Sure.
So what I'll do also with the social media site is I'll put up pictures right on of captions. Who are these people?
Yes.
People love it. It's like a crossword.
Sure.
They love chiming in.
Yes.
And then kind of tagging other folks. Hey, look, you're in this photo.
Yes.
Now what I do, even if I know the names on a photo, I don't put the names up because people just... they get such a kick out of it.
Yes,
and
yes.
I did this. So we are just about going into Passover as we record this.
Right.
Saturday night is Passover. Here we are on Tuesday. So every day this week, I'm putting up old Passover pictures that I have in my files, 60s, 70s, 80s.
Right.
And I started doing it on Sunday. I did it yesterday. I'll do it today. And when these go up, people just,
yes.
Oh my goodness, that's my mother. That's my grandfather. Yeah, that kind of thing. And it's fun.
Oh, yeah. Fun. Yeah. That creates just a great community.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's like a ongoing reunion.
And it's not always good and rosy, shiny stuff. You know, when you're into history, you got to be careful about nostalgia. Yes, you feel warm and fuzzy, but you don't want to distort the way things really were
right.
in favor of the way you might remember they were. So there are times for sad things and negative
sure.
things. And if somebody wants to say, I hated Hebrew school, that's fine. You know, if you want to say, I hated teacher such and such, no, that's not fine.
Right.
You
know, right.
But when people who were raised in Dayton in the Jewish community, when they pass, we'll put their obituaries up there so people will know that. If there are sad things that happened in the community, you know, we certainly do acknowledge that and
sure.
give people space to discuss it. So we do definitely try to keep it real.
Right, right. So were there some interesting stories of the business community that kind of surprised you or that you learned about as you were developing some of these articles?
I had always heard about Arthur Bierman.
Right.
How he was a tough guy. But along the way, I also found that he had a soft spot
okay,
for the community.
That was,
I loved finding soft spots where you didn't expect them.
Yes.
For example, the Thanksgiving dinner that he started
yes.
for those in need. He wanted to be exactly the same Thanksgiving dinner that he had with his family in his home.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, a longtime member of the Jewish community just passed, Jean Betty Weiner, who was tasked for so many years. I think she was 102. Amazing.
Oh, my.
With running that dinner for so many years.
That's interesting. I heard her name before, but I didn't realize that that's where it was from.
Yeah. And apparently this, really, it was his mortality that led him to this great gift for the community. He had had a heart attack.
Okay.
And the outpouring that the community showed him of caring, that this was a way he kind of wanted to give back.
Right.
Yeah. Another one, Dick Jacobs.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah. This was before my time.
Yes.
But he had, I think Fortune magazine had designated him one of the top 10 toughest bosses in America.
I'd heard that before. And when I read it in there, until I read it, I'd forgotten that. Yes.
And I mean, I this was before my time, but I see the picture and I'm like, oh, I could see that.
Yeah. He did have a real tough demeanor. Looking.
Right. But at the same time, he established a scholarship fund for children of firefighters and policemen who were killed in the line of duty.
Oh, no kidding. I never knew that either.
Yeah. Someone with the tough exterior, but with a heart of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Other thing I found interesting was exceptions to the rules. So we talk about Oakwood in particular being restricted
right.
from Jews, but there were exceptions. There were a few exceptions. And to me, the question is, okay, why? What was it about these individuals that, number one, they were allowed to live in Oakwood, and number two, that they were comfortable enough in their skin to live
sure.
in Oakwood? Now, the first one that I knew of was not Sam Thal, but Joe Thal.
Uh-huh. Yes. He had the women's clothing.
That's right. And my understanding, he had moved into Oakwood in the 1920s with his family. My understanding from my research was that his women's clothing store was not just a women's clothing store. It was absolutely the best quality women's clothing store.
Interesting.
Prior to Thal's women's clothing store, the spouses of the executives at NCR, they would only be able to get the clothes that suited their lifestyles in New York.
Oh.
Maybe Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Paris.
Yes.
This was somebody in Dayton who could certainly meet their needs, at least
okay.
until their next New York or Paris trip.
Yes.
There would be a reason to
mm-hmm.
keep somebody like Joe Thal happy.
Yes. So he was one of the first Jews allowed
I'm always reluctant to say the first because beware of the first. There's always somebody before that. But
that's probably
he's
true.
Probably the first one that I know of.
Yes, I see.
Right. The next one was Joseph Klein, was an optometrist.
Yes.
And he was John Patterson's optometrist.
Oh, right, right.
And this was a great story I found. Klein's granddaughter said to me, would you like my grandfather's memoirs, handwritten memoirs of his whole life?
Wow.
And a chapter deals with Patterson and Oakwood.
Yes.
So he was originally from England, and he opens his optometry office in Dayton, I believe late teens, early 20s. And one of his customers is Patterson's valet. Patterson's valet brings his son there, and he gets fitted for glasses. Fine. Patterson, for years, has had trouble getting the right prescription, getting fitted for prescriptions. He's been to ophthalmologists in Europe, and nobody's been able to get it right.
Yeah.
So the valet says to Patterson, you need to go and see Joseph Klein. Patterson goes to see Klein. Klein figures out a prescription that's going to work for him. But the other thing he figures out is that he kind of wears these pince-nez glasses, and they're just... they're distorted. They're just
right. Well, the early ones would bend easy, right?
Right, right. So he simply tells Patterson, okay, this is what you need to do. You need to switch from this kind of glasses to this kind of glasses. And Patterson just hems and haws and no, no, no. And Klein, it's in his memoirs, says to Patterson, you know, if I'm buying a cash register, I am going to listen to your advice and take it. If you are getting your eyes corrected, you need to listen to my advice and take it.
Yes.
And Patterson just laughs and says, why doesn't anyone else talk to me this way? Long story short,
yeah.
Klein corrects Patterson's vision problem.
Yes.
But what he doesn't correct, so Patterson has this habit when he's in a board meeting, when he's at a table with executives, he has this habit of pounding his hand on the table. But he does so, he takes his glasses off, the glasses are his hand, he keeps pounding them on the table. I believe he has to order 30 pairs of glasses of frames with prescriptions from Klein, who regularly has to visit Patterson at his home. Even with those all those pairs, he still has to
to get them bent just correctly back.
And the whole, what right, the time that they're spending talking together, Patterson is only talking about cash registers. So that was a fun story.
That was. I enjoyed that story, yes.
So.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun stories in your book that I really enjoyed that, you know, you just never hear those stories anyplace else.
And I am as amazed as anyone if I happen to stumble across them or somebody happens to send them my way. The process that I've gone through and that I continue to go through is I'll do a story on some aspect of history and I will take time with it and publish it in The Observer. And then I guess I start testing it out. So
sure.
When I do my regular talks around town for this group or that group, I'll put it out there.
Yes.
And then afterwards, invariably, somebody or other will come up to me after a talk and say, you know, this happened, or, you know, here's information you might want to include. And it kind of
builds
really,
on itself.
Right. So by the time I'm ready to put it into a book, I've got so much more than I ever bargained for.
Yes.
Because, you know, because just putting it out there, you never know what's going to come back.
That's great. I love it, that you're able to dig deeper into these details and
it's
find
fun.
This stuff out.
Yeah.
And it makes it so much fun when I read a book like that and pick up these little bits of information about somebody like Patterson that you wouldn't be able to read about anyplace else. And,
yeah.
And you'd hate for those stories to be lost to history and never published.
Well, the great biography of Patterson has yet to be written. And one of the reasons it has yet to be written, this is more of a Dayton history thing. They have acquired the Patterson Archive materials from NCR. It has yet to be processed. There's so much.
Yeah.
So much there. Mm-hmm. And it has not yet been sorted and ironed out. But my guess is there are many historians who are just waiting for that to get organized and to go through that. And
yes. Yes. I think that would be a fascinating book because his impact on everything from the cash register to sales technology and his early works with developing salesmen was instrumental in so many different areas that many people adopted from in the early sugar camp days and what happened there.
And of course, now sugar camp, a good section of it is part of the organized Jewish community. Who would
yes.
have ever thought that in Oakwood, where Jews really weren't supposed to live, couldn't live, Beth Abraham Synagogue is now
yes.
On the old NCR training
yes.
ground. Hillel Academy Jewish Day School is up there as well on the third floor. There's a ritual bath, the Dayton Community Mikveh for observant Jews is mm-hmm. also on that campus, right next to the two Jewish cemeteries.
Yes.
It is. This is an anchor in the Jewish community now.
Yes, and that's part of the story that, you know, needs to continually be told and provides, you know, a lot of background that people living here for many years still don't know about, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Now, there was always a joke that I had heard, and I think it probably goes back a generation or two. Jews couldn't live in Oakwood, but they could be buried there. And it's not quite exactly true because in the days when Oakwood was restricted to anyone who wasn't white, in those days, believe it or not, Jews were not considered white.
Okay.
It was very racist. The two Jewish cemeteries on Shantz, Beth Abraham and Riverview, which is Temple Israel, none of that is in Oakwood. So Beth Abraham is totally Kettering. Riverview at that time was all Kettering as well.
Okay.
Or I guess it might have even been Van Buren Township. There's only a sliver of land in the Riverview, Temple Israel Cemetery, that is Oakwood, and that only happened in the 1950s in kind of a land swap.
I see.
Because the original Jewish cemetery in town was surrounded by NCR land, and Patterson wondered that. It was Brown and Rubicon, and I forget the other cross street, but long story short, right now it's the parking lot of Flanagan's.
Okay. Well, I know he purchased it, and then they moved a lot of the—
Yeah, it's a complicated story, and it goes over like 70-some years. He wanted that land, so originally he purchases it, but allows the cemetery to remain there. This is the time when Temple Israel has already bought more land on Shantz for a larger cemetery.
Okay.
Nevertheless, those who have been buried at the old cemetery, some families, if they choose to, they can keep them there. If they want to reinter and put them in the new one. Long story short, it was in the 1950s when NCR gives Temple Israel a sliver of land in Oakwood, and in exchange for that, basically, they want to wrap up the whole cemetery thing. They're also giving the money to disinter and reinter the remaining, you'll excuse this, the remaining remains.
Yes.
So this finally happens in 1967, where the last remains are exhumed and reinterred at Temple Israel. And you'll see it, there's something called the Founder's Circle. They've put all these remains and headstones together.
I see.
The part that's closest to Oakwood. But I understand there are a few people still around who were part of that move. And they told me how painstaking it was to get a hold of, to first of all, track down families.
Yes, I'm
sure. From 100 plus years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And then to get their okay.
Yeah.
To get that
right
done. So now, yes, Oakwood is part of the Riverview Cemetery, but not a whole lot.
Wow. So. Wow. Yeah, just so many history.
And it's confusing.
Parts. Yeah, it is. It is complicated. Right. History is messy and complicated like that,
and
isn't it?
There's a tall tale associated with that in the Jewish community that is entirely untrue that started my research on this, and I can't say enough. This is not true. But I've heard so many different versions of it from when I came to town. It usually starts with, John Patterson hated the Jews.
Oh.
And it's something to do with Kettering, Charles Kettering, who had been fired from Patterson probably a lot of times. Knowing that John Patterson didn't like the Jews is the one that was in charge of the transaction to get Jewish cemetery land in Oakwood. And none of that is true. Absolutely not. It's not true. It's a great story, but it's not true anyway.
Well, it's interesting you were able to dig that out.
And it wasn't that hard. First of all, at the time when the land was purchased for those Jewish cemeteries, Charles Kettering, I think, was in high school, maybe first year of college.
Okay, all right.
No, number one. Number two, the idea that John Patterson hated the Jews is way too broad a brush to paint. No,
sure.
His legacy with the Jewish community is much more nuanced. Yes, he did not want anyone but white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in his haven of Oakwood. That is correct. At the same time, in the general community and within the Jewish community, he worked with the Jewish community, with the leaders of the Jewish community, for the betterment of the whole community.
That's what I understand. Your book brings that out very nicely,
lots
too.
Lots of, I wouldn't say personal friendships, but for the betterment of the community, he was very forward in actively working with the leaders of the Jewish community. So it's not, I think the tricky thing with life these days is people look at things as, well, it's either this or it's that. And there's so much nuance. There's so much nuance in these stories. So in some ways, I think that my work has been able to an extent, to rehabilitate John Patterson with what really happened, as opposed to the resentment, maybe well-earned from the Jewish community.
That's why we need researchers like yourself to dig into this and to put it into a form that people can actually realize what the true story is, rather than living off these long tales, right?
And then there are also people who don't want to absorb that.
I'm sure there's always history
denied. My grandfather told me X. My grandmother told me that. But, you know, if my grandfather said it, it's got to be, you know. And my job is not to poke anybody's bears or to tweak anybody right. or offend, but you know, this is, here it is. This is what
sure.
happened. And
sure.
I didn't know your grandmother. I'm sure she was lovely.
Oh, I loved hearing about all the different and seeing all the different pictures of all the different people in there, from Miriam Rosenthal to Jesse Phillips and, you know, Jacobs, as you mentioned there, and the Bierman family. And the list just goes on and on and on, learning. And I could spend hours chatting with you about a lot of this. So it's been, you know, just so much fun revisiting a lot of these people and a lot of these names and learning about what the history of the immigration was like. So you've done a phenomenal job here. I do want to ask one thing. You know, you have such a broad information. Is there a plans for another book?
Well, I've got plans for a few more books, but I'm not sure exactly when I'll get to them. The second book, I didn't even think it would be out by now. It came out in 2021, but I guess a subtitle to that book could be What I Did During COVID.
Okay.
Yeah, right now I do have ideas for two or three more books percolating, but at the present moment, I don't have the time because there are so many things that I have to cover locally going on that affect our Jewish community. And unfortunately, most of them involve anti-Semitic acts and anti-Israel acts, the kind of crossover into anti-Semitism. This is going on all over the country, and Dayton is not immune to that. So hopefully things settle down eventually, and I'll be able to get to some of those books.
Yeah.
Actually, one idea that I have, I don't know if I'm the person to write it, but I think there's a great children's book in the story of the Schwartz sisters.
Yes.
And how they taught on Linden Avenue and how DCDC came out of that. Ever since I heard that story, since I read about it, I thought this would be a great children's book.
Yeah, I think
So if anybody's a children's book author out there and is interested in this, have at it.
No, you got a lot of wonderful ideas there. You know, as far as the Jewish Observer, you know, I was kind of interested as I was looking online at all the different people and the stories that you have going on there is, you know, what kind of motivates you right now and how do you envision that growing into the future for the Jewish community and the community as a whole?
Well, what's amazed me the most is since I've been here, there's never a dearth of stories to write about. There's always, for a relatively small Jewish community, there's always something interesting going on. And beyond the things that are just negative stories that I have to write, if you just scratch a little below the surface, there's stories of how people are kind of finding new ways to express their Judaism or, because of their Jewish values, are just making a difference in the general community. It's amazing if you just stop and listen. An old journalistic adage, just get out of the way and let the story tell itself.
Well, that's right.
And that's what I really try to do.
Yeah. And there have been so many contributions. For the people listening, the two books that I have with me that I was referring to in the podcast here are Images of America, Jewish Community of Dayton, that Marshall has done a great job of compiling, just a wonderful group of photos and little stories about. And then Stories of Jewish Dayton is the one that has all the great stories in great detail about the immigration, the history, up to current events that have happened throughout Dayton, and a lot of lost stories that need to be revisited. I think anybody would certainly find both books well worth their time. I assume that they're easily accessible.
Oh, yeah. All over town, you can find them at Amazon, other places online. This is the Arcadia Press and History Press. They are great with distribution. So if you go to pick up a prescription at your pharmacy, you'll see a rack of local history books that they published, and you'll see these among them.
Very nice. Yes. What advice would you give any aspiring writers and journalists who want to follow in your footsteps? I mean, you've done a great job of developing a newspaper and developing books and writing history, and certainly could be an inspiration to a lot of people.
Well, thank you. From a journalistic perspective, there are fewer jobs than there ever have been. But if you work hard and you're willing to learn, if you're willing to humble yourself and remember that you can always get better and you will get better, you'll get a job in the field. I have someone who just graduated from college who was writing for me for a few months, and she just got hired on as a journalist with a journalist degree.
Nice.
In California. So it can happen, but you've got to be committed to getting better. After all these years, I'm only as good as my last issue. And the first thing that I see when I look at an issue that's been printed online is, what could I have done better? On the history end of it, it also follows an adage from journalism. You know, in journalism school, you're taught, if your mother says she loves you, confirm it. And it's the same in history. Don't take any organization's history as factually correct. They don't always get it wrong intentionally. A lot of times it could be because they're going from memory and not actually history. Find the documentation to confirm every historical fact. It's very important.
That's wonderful. Well, you've done a great job with these books. I enjoyed going online and reading some of the current works that you've done with the Jewish Observer. Is it free online?
Oh, it's free online, and the publication is free too. We put them in many locations around town for people to pick up. Anyone who wants to receive it by mail, I am happy to add you to our mailing list. Our philosophy has always been one of outreach, that whoever wants to receive it, whether they're Jewish, non-Jewish, we want you to have it. And at this point, I would say that about a quarter, almost a third of our readers are not necessarily Jewish. They want to see what's going on.
Well, I think there's a lot of information in there around just the general community that I found very interesting. So how do they get a hold of you if they want to subscribe?
Well, my email address, letter MWEISS, as in Sam, at jfgd.net. So it's MWEISS at jfgd.net. And I will be glad to add you to our list to get it every month.
Wonderful. I think a lot of people would really enjoy that. I know I'll be looking in on a regular basis too. This has been a great day. We really appreciate your time. What you've done here is magnificent. I would encourage everybody to get the books and to start following Marshall's doing in town here, because he is certainly one of Dayton's gems.
Oh, well, thank you.
We thank you for your time and effort and everything you're doing today for our community.
It's an honor to be with you today.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of the Next Gen Podcast. It has been a pleasure to have Marshall Weiss with us, sharing his incredible insights and stories about Jewish history in Dayton. His work has truly brought to light the rich and vibrant history of the Jewish community. Until next time, stay curious, stay inspired, and keep exploring stories that shape our lives.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Next Gen Podcast. To learn more about our team and to join our exclusive educational events throughout the year, check out our website at advisors.ubs.com/Energen. If you have any suggestions on episodes you'd like to hear, let us know by emailing us at energen@ubs.com. And if you liked this episode, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to hear more. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of any offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we recommend listeners to obtain appropriate and independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct our business and that you carefully read agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products and services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.